invest in your future today with a degree or certificate from Shasta College. Get job ready fast with one of our high demand career technical programs like nursing, heavy equipment, and welding. Or work on transferring to a CSU or UC with guaranteed placement. Full-time students get 2 years tuition free. Summer session begins June 9th. Click or call 242-7650. Your success starts at Shasta College.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Save 20 to 30% off all plants at Turtle Bay's 33rd Annual Spring Plant Sale, featuring heirloom vegetables, hard-to-find perennials, shrubs, California natives, and more. The nursery specializes in drought-tolerant plants that thrive in Redding's climate. The members-only sale will take place on Friday, April 4th, 4 to 7 p.m., and the public sale will be held on Saturday, April 5th, 9 to 3 p.m. at 1100 Arboretum Drive. Learn more at turtlebaynursery.org.
Hey, it's your liberty-loving Latino amigo, Rich Valdez, host of America at Night. Weeknights, we're letting you know what's happening live all across America. We'll have newsmakers and experts coming on, talking about the hot topics of the day. Plus, in our third hour, whatever you want to talk about with open phones across America, our nightly town hall. I look forward to hearing from you on the next America at Night with me, Rich Valdez.
Weeknights from 7 to 10 p.m. on KCNR.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Financial Advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Join Token's radio show every Tuesday night starting at 6 on 96.5 FM and AM 1460 as host Christy Matthews and Linda Kent explore the exciting world of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Learn how Bitcoin is revolutionizing finance and grasp sound money principles. Hear new perspectives on achieving financial freedom beyond broken institutions. The future of money is here. Empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to Token's radio show with Linda and Christy Tuesday nights at 6 on KCNR.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
personally, because that fourth branch of government destroyed his first term, was the reason he did not get reelected in 2020, and is the reason why he faced 700 years in federal prison. President Donald Trump is counterattacking the fourth branch of government that tried to stop him over the last decade.
Kirk continues by discussing the question, who is the sovereign? Who is in charge? And what it's like to fire executive branch employees?
Do you notice that when we fire a federal worker, it's like we're going to fire like the Archbishop of Phoenix or something? Like, it's like unbelievable. Like, they're totally untouchable. Like, you can't do that. Why? Who made them that they are in some sort of holy realm that we can't ask the question, well, what do you do here? Why do you exist? What is your job? You can't say that. No, instead, we have to act as if they're the untouchables. Literally. And if you listen to the media coverage carefully, it's like, we work for them. But no, it's not the way. They work for us. Because our document starts morally clear, we the people of the United States. Not the we, the USAID, you know, purple-haired jihadis that are sending money to Kazakhstan to trans the kids, right? That's not how it works, actually. And these sound like such fundamental basic questions, but we're about to get down to the root of the matter. You know why? Because our leaders have prolonged the inevitable for decades. George W. Bush did not have the moral clarity or the gusto to pick this fight. In fact, he grew the Leviathan and grew the administrative state. We have new agencies because of Republican presidents. So this has been a fight that has been delayed for far too long, and this is where it is all heading. And so when it comes down to who is the sovereign, it comes down to, well, we the American people elected a president to be able to do the job. And it still baffles the mind where I hear in some of these meetings when I'm in D.C., well, you can't fire these federal workers. You could put them on administrative leave. And how many of you guys in your corporate career or you run a business, what could ever operate that way? Nothing. And yet we put the federal government in a completely different bucket for no good constitutional reason.
We're hearing excerpts from a national leadership seminar lecture by Charlie Kirk. Kirk says now we actually have a chance to make real change.
The reason they're fighting so hard on DOGE and on what we are experiencing is we actually have a chance to do the thing that people thought that could never get done, which is we actually have a chance to reorient the ship back to the founders' intent, to restore the three branches of government, to articulate what Article 2 actually is. And I think we have a shot at doing it. Article 1 is the hardest because Congress is a disaster. But I think the Supreme Court is actually willing to hear this out for the first time in a generation. I think the Supreme Court is now willing to hear the arguments. What do you mean you're an independent agency? No, you're not an independent agency. You serve under Article 2. And we've seen with some decisions, the Chevron deference decision, the EPA decision, that the courts are signaling that they're ready for these monumental type cases. And what that means, everybody, is that the administrative state Leviathan, this regime that has been swallowing our freedom and liberty post Woodrow Wilson, for the first time, we can reverse it. We can go back to where we came from. But it's not just going to happen because of one election. It will only happen with a free citizenry demanding it out of your leaders with vocal support on a daily basis, educating the masses of what's really going on. And I believe we have a shot at doing it because we're able to communicate to millions of people in a moment's notice without having to go through the Washington Post.
Charlie Kirk concludes by discussing the importance of Donald Trump's second term in the Oval Office and the hopes of beating back the administrative states.
That's the true revolution that's occurring, is that we are taking the bold and courageous move that is going to put a lot of people's lives and fortunes and sacred honors at risk to say, subject no more, citizen. Because we have lived as subjects for the last couple of years, whether we realize it or not. We have not been citizens, which is co-rulers or co-authorities of our own nation. And that's where the Trump thing gets way bigger than Trump. And honestly, God bless this guy for being the man in the arena that Teddy Roosevelt has always talked about, having the courage and the stamina. God bless him for not taking the deal where they said, you know, don't run for president and just being kingmaker and doubling down, getting shot, his whole business empire nearly taken from him, and now getting into what is the most high-stakes fight constitutionally, morally, and civilizationally. And you guys know this. Europe is not going to save a free society. Europe is gone. It's a husk of its former self. We got the Chinese Communist Party rising up. If it's not us, it's nobody. As Dr. Arnott said, it is the last best hope. And it's only us if we can actually win the domestic war first. If we can restrain this beast that has been slowly taking over every one of our ways of life over the last couple decades, and especially the last 100 years.
That was Charlie Kirk, those excerpts from a national leadership seminar lecture in Phoenix in February. Charlie Kirk, the founder and CEO of Turning Point USA, also nationally syndicated radio host. His lecture, Hitting the Ground Running, the Trump Transition and Early Priorities, available in full at freedomlibrary.hillsdale.edu. Up next, we're joined by Christina Lam Chakalova from Hillsdale's Art Department. We talk about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to What's in a Name. Though this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story, it's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which in turn comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. So the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago. The land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Mary, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the separation of church and state.
America's founders believed in a separation of church and state, in that the country was not to have an official religion or an official sect. But that did not mean that government was to be hostile to religion or even indifferent to religion, as many today argue. In fact, America's founding document, the Declaration of Independence, includes both a reference to God as the author of the laws of nature and a confident assertion that human beings are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Far from being hostile or indifferent to religion, America's founders understood the theology of the Declaration to be an essential part of the education of citizens.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Whether you've just started teaching or spent decades in the classroom, you know there's always more to learn. But where do you start? Well, here at Hillsdale College, we have the answer for you. Tried and true. A primer on sound pedagogy by Hillsdale College professor Daniel Copeland. In this little book, you'll read lessons from more than 25 years of Dr. Copeland's classroom experience. It's all distilled into 14 easy-to-read chapters on lesson planning, assignments, and classroom management. And it will help you improve your skills and inspire you as a teacher, one of our most important professions. Whether you've been in front of the classroom for years, or this is your first year, when you read Tried and True, you'll find something to help you keep improving every single day. You don't need to go at it alone. Let Dr. Copeland's real-world experience encourage you and inspire you. You can get your copy today at hillsdale.edu/true. That's hillsdale.edu/true.
Welcome to the Old Ball Game, where we talk about the past of America's favorite pastime. I'm Tate Christensen. Today we talk about baseball in the Civil War. Baseball was a favorite pastime of soldiers in both the Union and in the Confederacy, but it was especially popular in the North with the Union officers. Soldiers of both sides used a variety of sports to entertain themselves in their downtime, but baseball was the most popular. Soldiers often talked about baseball in their letters back home, their diaries, and in their newspapers. They would play the most baseball in the winter and the spring months when they were not busy with the war. Soldiers would spend time playing baseball and watching baseball, as armies would host different games playing one another and often drew large crowds. A Christmas Day game in 1862 drew a crowd of 40,000 soldier spectators. During the war, in 1857, the National Association of Baseball Players was formed. It was the first governing body for baseball, and it met annually. This has been the Old Ball Game on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova. She is Assistant Professor of Art here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Chikalova, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
You recently taught a course, History of American Art, which I thought would be an interesting conversation for our listeners. And so we'll spend a couple of segments talking about history, how we define American art, what it looks like, some changes throughout time. I think it'll be interesting, and you do too, so listeners certainly will too. We start with that definitional part, and this is a big question. You spend almost an entire term trying to answer this question, but how would you define, or how should we define, American art?
So it's a really great question. It's also a really challenging question, and I made this primary goal of the course that I taught last fall. And by the end of the semester, we realized that there's no monolithic definition to this answer. We considered everything from Native American art forms and architecture, art during the colonial period, all the way up to the modern day. And again, we concluded that this is so difficult to define because, on the one hand, art is art, just like science is science. It's just universal. It's mm-hmm. part of human nature. But what we did realize about American art is that it's very much part of the Western artistic tradition. It engages in the same art forms, in the same questions as most Western art engages in. And what really sets it apart then from other Western art forms is ambition. That's really the one thing that we all kind of unilaterally agreed upon by the very last day of the semester when we had a discussion about, you know, what is American about American art? And there were lots of things that we came up with: diversity of materials, forms, subjects, etc. But certainly ambition was really important. And we found that a lot of American artists will engage in traditional mediums and in traditional subjects, but mm-hmm. in new and exciting ways. And one of the reasons for that is because, unlike, for example, Europe, where we have hundreds of years of patrons of art, the church, nobles, kings and queens, then we have the formation of art academies, a lot of that was missing mm-hmm. in America. And so where did art come in then? Why did it become so ambitious? Because it was communicating perhaps more directly with the general public. And so it needed to stand out in some ways. And it's ambitious in that regard because of the fact that it needed to stand out either commercially or for its beauty or for its interest or for the subject matter. It had to draw people to it, which is different than, again, in these European contexts where it's the church or it's right. the king or it's an art academy where this work has a venue for display. American artists kind of had to pave their own way. And so we felt that if there is one way we can define American art, certainly ambition is one of those words that we all agreed upon, which there were not too many that we all agreed upon, but that was definitely one.
What kind of cultural influences do you believe, and the class perhaps believe, contributed to the distinctiveness of American art?
Well, cultural influences here, well, when it comes to Native American art forms, we felt that there was a lot of kind of cultural continuity in the types of materials and approaches. For example, using natural materials mm-hmm. very innovatively, basket weaving, ceramics, you know, these are things that require you to be very tuned in to the environment. And so we felt that, especially with Native American art, it's very, very tuned in to the American landscape. And that's actually not quite different, actually, from perhaps some of the most prominent American art forms that are quite distinct, which made me think then of, like, landscape painting, for example, mm-hmm. whereas in Europe, in the late 18th century, landscape painting really finally is accepted as an outstanding medium in the United States. At the same time, Americans were really in tune to the American landscape, manifest destiny. The country is expanding, and in America, landscape painting became such an important and appreciated art form in a way that was like unprecedented compared to in Europe, where it was beloved and beautiful, but just couldn't necessarily compete with other genres and mediums like history painting, you know, a huge painting of ancient Roman history, something that's a noble subject matter that would have been preferenced in Europe at the same time over American art forms like landscape painting, which I think is certainly distinct. So I think that the American landscape is incredibly influential, that leads to a kind of distinctness in certain art styles that are popular amongst the American public, or even art styles that are preferenced by Native Americans, which have a deeper cultural kind of spiritual meaning perhaps. And I also thought about some of the distinctness of the earliest days of American art, like in the colonial period, you know, what is one of the most important cultural influences at that time? Certainly a kind of like neoclassical style. If something is culturally distinct about American art, whether indigenous art forms or some of the greatest art of America generally, it's the landscape, but also certainly European influence is very, very strong. And I think that's one of the reasons why we also had trouble defining American art, is because it does engage in the ideas and the traditions of the Europeans who came first, but then it does take on its own American ambitious flavor.
Talking with Dr. Christina Lamb Jakalova. She is assistant professor of art here at Hillsdale College on the history of American art, how we define it. What are some ways that American artists have challenged or perhaps reinforced some prevailing stereotypes or narratives about American identity?
So this was one of the challenges that was one of my favorite. So I kind of divided the course up into different challenges, how American art engages in nature or in identity or challenges like adversity or commemoration. And I feel like this was one of the most interesting ideas to think about, this question about American identity, how art engages in it, especially at the time of our nation's founding. And so here I have a kind of like interesting example. John Singleton Copley did a very famous portrait of Paul Revere, who happened to be a silversmith. He was very successful in Boston. I think most of us know who Paul Revere is. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting portrait because of the way that Paul Revere is depicted, not in his best clothes, but in work attire. He's holding a silver object on the table. He's not looking at the artist who's painting him, but he's looking at the object that he has created before him. And it's a work of art that's all about this idea that Americans are hardworking people who are self-made individuals, and it's not about his status, it's not about his clothing or the setting. It's unprecedentedly casual for a portrait of the time period. And it doesn't want to emphasize his social status or his family's wealth or political authority, religious authority, none of that. It's just an emphasis on Paul Revere and his accomplishments as an individual.
We will pause there and return in a moment for more with Christina Lamb Jakalova from Hillsdale's Art Department about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to KCNR 96.5 FM at 1460 AM, your talk radio. Online at KCNR1460.com.
The Reading Regional Chapter of Safari Club International 31st Annual Banquet will be Saturday, April 26th at the Wind River Events Center. Doors will open at 5 p.m. There will be games, live and silent auctions, and drawings, which will include over $35,000 in prizes for hunting, camping, and plenty of items for the ladies. We look forward to a fun evening in support of the world's largest wildlife conservation organization. To purchase tickets, go to scireading.org. That's scireading.org.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Reading, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson, and find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC and equal housing lender.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Starting March 12th, every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
It's April, and you know what that means. Hot Cars and Cool April Nights is back. This year is going to be bigger than ever, so mark your calendars for 10 days of classic car fun. This year has more show and shines, a drive-in movie, and don't forget about the cruise on Friday, April 25th, followed by the biggest show and shine of them all on Saturday, April 26th. 2,000 classic cars on display, tons of great food, amazing unique vendors, and tons of chances for you to win with a poker walk and raffle city throughout the day. Get your wristbands at any local Napa Auto Parts store. And remember, Cool April Nights returns April 18th through the 27th. So update those calendars now and also get a full schedule of events at CoolAprilNights.com. Okay, to recap, Cool April Nights starts on Friday, the 18th. Goes for the next 10 days through April 27th, with the big cruise happening on Friday the 25th and the biggest show and shine of them all on April 26th. We'll see you cruising this April.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Reading Rodeo is back in Bucking on the River, May 14th through 17th. Celebrating 77 years of nonstop rodeo action, world champion cowboys competing in the largest four-day rodeo in Northern California. Don't miss our 77th annual Reading Rodeo tradition. Get your tickets now only at readingrodeo.com before they're gone. Reading Rodeo, where the West comes alive, May 14th through 17th.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope. That's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts, Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51. Jefferson State of Mind.
Join me, Mark Levin, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. KCNR, your talk radio.
Donald Trump is doing something that's never been done in American history.
Now, what Trump is trying to do all at once, he wants to what I call reindustrialize America.
Mark Levin is on the radio.
KCNR, your talk radio.
So I think it's a very fascinating work of art because it's unfinished. And it's all about that point about American identity as being one that's, self-made, proud of your accomplishments. But again, the Brits didn't want to sit for that picture because they weren't ready to commemorate the American identity in that way.
How has American art been received or interpreted by international audiences, outsiders? How has it shaped perceptions of American culture abroad?
You know, I think that also takes me back to, it's a very good question that also makes me think about the time of our nation's founding. And I would bring in here another example, which is very famous and perhaps most viewers have seen or at least know about, by Trumbull, the Declaration of Independence, the famous picture that's in the rotunda of the Capitol building where everybody is kind of signing this work of art. And here too, men who are technically engaged in an act of high treason, but they're being depicted by the artist as very civilized individuals. They are shown like gentlemen who are standing around and debating important American ideals. And this is a work of art that ended up in the rotunda along with three other very important paintings. They were installed in 1826 to kind of reinforce these ideas about an American identity and challenge British stereotypes about Americans, who were these kind of crazy people who broke away from the crown, but of course accomplished something outstanding. And so I think that works of art like that did intend to shape European audiences about, you know, thinking about the American experiment as being one of the greatest intellectual endeavors of the time and should not be painted with the broad brush of treason, because, of course, that was not the goal. The goal was to, you know, like a new human experiment in essence. Certainly, though, American art has also shaped perceptions of American culture abroad at other points in history. So I don't intend to just focus on that time period, but I also thought a little bit about the Civil War period when especially African American artists went abroad. One interesting person is named Edmonia Lewis. So she was a female sculptor who was educated at Oberlin College, and then she also had a lot of sculptural training in Boston. She was Roman Catholic, and she became this kind of face for the abolitionist movement about, you know, look at everything that one can accomplish with the right education, with the right financial social support and backing. And so she did actually make a name for herself here, and then she actually went over to Rome as well, where she felt that she could be a little bit more successful perhaps than in the United States, because, well, she was an outstanding sculptor, but there was a lot of focus on her race in the United States, mm-hmm. whereas when she got to Rome, there was just more focus on her Catholicism and her accomplishments as a sculptor, perhaps even in spite of her race. I can think of another artist who had a very similar situation, Henry Ossewa Tanner, who was an American Impressionist working in and around Philadelphia. And he went to France. That's where he had kind of the greatest part of his career. And he helped to kind of shape some of those perceptions about American culture abroad, and also the merits of African Americans in the artistic sphere, which is really something that became more important after the Civil War period.
Talking with Dr. Christina Lamb Chakalova. She is Assistant Professor of Art here at Hillsdale College. We've talked about founding years. We're going to spend time on different themes in a future conversation, but I wanted to close this talk with a little more about the present and maybe the future. Emerging artists or emerging movements in American art that might be shaping the future of art.
Well, this made me think about an artist named Jeff Koons, who is a contemporary artist. And I have to say that, you know, with the future of American art, we live in such a global world today. And we had trouble defining American art in the earlier days. I think I have even more trouble defining it in the here and now, because we just live in such an international world. But one artist who is of American origin is Jeff Koons, who I think is probably definitely impacting the modern and contemporary art world in an interesting way. He is the famous guy who made the balloon dogs that are now made out of stainless steel. Mm-hmm. He's famous for the most expensive dog in the world, which some of his little balloon dogs also got shattered by gallery visitors who were not so careful. And I think his art is so interesting because he's thinking about nostalgic childhood experiences, turning those into works of art, because why not? It's postmodern art. You know, let's make everything art. And he really tries to think about art that makes the viewer unite visually and psychologically with what is presented before them. Visually, because, well, in the balloon dog, you'll see your reflection. Psychologically, because you'll have nostalgic memories of your childhood. His art is pioneering in that way, but also for its commercialism. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say what he's doing is fascinating. Others say it's just done in bad taste. But what he's trying to do is challenge the very notion of, like, what art is, what it has to look like. So it's very postmodern in that way. And I think that's the current debate in the modern art world is, well, what is art at all?
Dr. Christina Lamb Chakalova, she is Assistant Professor of Art here at Hillsdale College. We'll spend more time at a future conversation on the history of American art and what is, how do you define American art? Dr. Chakalova, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, Dr. Ellen Condit, a teacher at Hillsdale Academy, adjunct professor here at Hillsdale College, will talk to us about the importance of memorization. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
You have a choice when it comes to your cancer care, and I want you to know that at Valor Oncology, we are here to provide the best possible care right here in Reading. I'm Dr. Lauren Strickland, Valor's breast oncology surgeon, and I'm proud to serve this community that I call home. When you come to Valor Oncology, you'll see the same dedicated team at every visit, physicians who know your history and are committed to your care. We offer state-of-the-art technology that rivals major cancer centers, combined with the personalized care you deserve. We are not just a team of doctors. We are part of the fabric of this community, and we are here for you today and tomorrow. When it comes to your health, you deserve expert care, compassion, and stability. Ask your doctor to refer you to Valor Oncology because we're committed to you and we're committed to Reading. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation. Valor Oncology, rooted in Reading, focused on you.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can find older episodes of this program plus other great Hillsdale College audio at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Ellen Condit. She is an English teacher at Hillsdale Academy, also an adjunct professor of education and English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Condit, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Talking today about a lecture you gave in defense of memorization. With texts available at our fingertips via phones, computers, why should we make it a point to memorize anything at all?
It's a defense that we have to make now for exactly that reason. In previous decades and when our grandparents and great-grandparents were being educated, memorization was just the standard. Mm-hmm. Everybody memorized poetry. Everybody memorized hymns. They knew all of those things from memory. But we do have to find reasons to come back to this practice that has even pretty largely been vilified. Over again, we hear about the dangers and the stultifying and monotony of rote memorization. And it's always a critique. But it is a particular kind of learning that used to be held in high esteem. To know something by heart was to know it in a way that wasn't possible when you were reading words off of the page. Once it's written on the heart, in the heart, there's something different that happens. There's a kind of ownership that happens of the words, and those words can take on a sort of life of their own, can help to shape how we think, help to shape how we feel and inform our impressions and interpretations of things that happen around us. Got lots of great scriptural injunction for us to store up words and store up commandments and meditate on those things. And over again, we get the sense that there is something significant that's happening beyond just having a sort of photographic representation, a Xerox of words that's planted in our brains that we can go back to, that this becomes a sort of indwelling reality that helps to form and shape us in ways that we're not going to understand until later in life even.
I want to ask even about that phrase, because we don't say generally, oh, I know that in my brain. We say, I know it by heart, or as you said previously, it's written on my heart or something along those lines. What is, why do we say that? Why not? It's in my brain. No. It's in my heart.
Yeah. The history of that phrase, I haven't researched. I mean, it is in scripture in Proverbs, that we're to write these commandments on the table of our hearts. And it comes up again in different places in the Bible. So I think that it's largely a scriptural metaphor that keeps coming around over again, even though we've largely forgotten that in our public consciousness. But there is something, especially in the Old Testament, the heart being the seat of the man, not the seat of emotions, mm-hmm. although yes, that as well, but the whole of the person is concentrated there. So instead of it being a pure intellectual exercise, it is part of the whole of our person. So it'd be an interesting thing to trace backwards and see how that phrase has been interpreted through centuries. Mm-hmm. But I know it's got roots back at least as far as scripture.
From an educational perspective or a classroom perspective, what are potential advantages for memorization, whether it be language skills, memory training? What do we gain through memorization?
I think it's one of those things where you can find the science that you want to find when you're researching this. Myself, teaching in a classroom, I see benefits of it all the time in having that shared knowledge to go back to. I know what the students have memorized, and when I want to draw them back to a point, we recite the line or lines together and have a quick access to a valuable line or phrase or stanza that gets to an important philosophical point that I want to make. Easier than flipping back in books, it's really nice to have those things to hand, mm-hmm. And have beautiful words to go back to remind us of this this principle that helps to inform our new discussion or the new book that we're reading. So there is something about having a sort of treasure trove of valuable, you know, flowers of learning back in the Middle Ages, a sort of compendium of Florilegia is a compounded together of beautiful quotations, sort of like Bartlett's Book of Quotations, mm-hmm. which nobody uses anymore, but used to be sort of the standard graduation gift. So to have those things already in your mind and quick, easy access to them is a useful thing, yes, but also helps us to make new and different connections as we add more to that storehouse that we've got inside our heads. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I find it useful in the classroom level, but we're not just thinking about usefulness. We practice memorization because we think it does have value for the brain, for how we remember, how we add things to memory, and how we figure out pathways to access memory as well.
Talking with Dr. Ellen Condit about in defense of memorization, does that also lead to building a specific culture inside of school, and can that concept be applied outside of educational institutions?
Yeah, it is a nice feature of being at a small school where for years I've taught all of the upper school students, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, and the students all do, they have some choice, but they all have the same basic memorization pieces that they do. So every student has that same storehouse of basic works that we come back to. There is a sense of pride about that. They're proud of what they've memorized. It becomes a kind of shorthand. When we're discussing things, they don't have to explain themselves. They go back to the line and everybody knows what it means. Mm-hmm. There's something incredibly useful in that, but also really, really lovely in the way we've got the shared common knowledge. And of course, it's not just in schools that we do this. Any liturgical church is doing the same. Even team sports where we're chanting the same things or coming back to the same maxims or credos. There's some kind of a cohesive unity and identity that comes from knowing the same phrases and holding them together to be true and being able to recite them back. I think that's always a helpful unifying thing for a group of people to have something to hold on to together and know it by heart together in community.
On the subject of approach, Is there a need to think about this or teach it in a way that prevents it from being monotonous? You mentioned that term earlier in the conversation, that it's not something that is monotonous for the students.
Yeah, I think it has to start with young children. They naturally enjoy reciting back. They enjoy poems. They enjoy fun poetry. And making it fun when they're young is tremendously helpful. By the time I get kids in high school, it can be a real slog if they haven't already enjoyed memorization in the past. They need to be convinced of its value and find some kind of enjoyment in the process. I think that does come with time. Even students who've never done it before, they can eventually come around to an appreciation for it because it's a different kind of brain work. It doesn't take interpretation. It doesn't take deep thought. It is a sort of mechanical process that once they've done it a few times, they can see the rewards that come from it. It may take a little while to sink in, but it is a kind of mental break in our day. We do a lot of literary analysis and discussion, but this doesn't require real thought in the same way. We do process the lines and talk about them, but the memorization itself, storing it in memory, is something that's kind of restful in a way. In some ways, easy once we get in the habit of it.
Does that memorized content, the things that we memorize, resonate differently the older we get, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely. I only started memorizing maybe 20 years ago, and I find every once in a while, I mean, a revelation as I'm working through a poem with students, all of a sudden, wait a minute, oh, that's what that means. And I think we've all had that experience with songs, right?
Uh-huh.
Lyrics of songs that you loved when you were a kid, and all of a sudden you're singing along with your kids in the car. I'm like, oh, that's what that means. Oh, no. you have this horrifying realization, but it does sink in over time. And we have, with greater life experience, we suddenly understand things in a new way. Or with the more reading we do, we suddenly get the illusions that we missed when we were younger. So it is the kind of thing that ripens with age and maturity and with greater knowledge of more literature and more aspects of life. Suddenly things are going to be made clear to us later.
Dr. Ellen Condit, in defense of memorization, she's an English teacher at Hillsdale Academy, adjunct professor of education and English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Condit, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Charlie Kirk. We heard excerpts from his National Leadership Seminar lecture. Dr. Christina Lam-Chakolova from Hillsdale's Art Department and Ellen Condit. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio, including YouTube. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Despite how long clotheslines have been in existence, which is about how long laundry has, they actually can be quite controversial. If you have ever lived in a condominium complex, an area with an HOA, or a general closed community with its own set of rules, then you may have encountered a ban on clotheslines. However, Vermont has decided to take a stance against any rules outlawing air drying your clothing outside by banning the banning of clotheslines. As of May 27, 2009, according to the Vermont statutes, no municipalities or other associations may ban clotheslines, solar panels, or other renewable energy sources. The state and other states with similar laws are considered right-to-dry states, where its residents are guaranteed to be able to hang their clothes out to dry, as well as participate in other energy-conserving activities. Florida was the first to pass such a law in the 1970s, with other states gradually following. There are currently 19 states with similar laws. Push for these bans comes from a want to be more environmentally friendly, including air-drying clothes instead of relying on a dryer. However, local community guidelines may outlaw this, as some may consider it ugly or not aesthetically pleasing. These laws are often put in place after a lawsuit between an individual and the complex they live in regarding this issue, and then eventually becomes the precedent within the state for the universal allowance of clotheslines. So, if you happen to be hanging your clothes out to dry in Vermont and someone gives you trouble, know that you won't be airing dirty laundry by standing up to them. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hello, I'm Nafa, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is Hillsdale President Larry Arnn on Congress granting itself legal exemptions.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to us, but not to Congress, is, quote, the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our fathers.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To join the national conversation on the Constitution, go to constitutionminute.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.